Okay, welcome everyone to this evening's meeting of the Aristotelian Society. I'm afraid our President Mari McGinn is unwell today, so I'll be chairing today's session. It's my great pleasure to introduce Kieran Setia. Kieran's Associate Professor at the University of Pittsburgh. He's written a number of papers on practical reason, practical knowledge, intention, and moral philosophy. He's the author of a book, Reasons Without Rationalism, published in 2007. And I believe he's also recently finished writing a book, Knowing Right from Wrong, which is to be published by Oxford University Press. And the title of Kieran's talk tonight is Knowing How. Thanks very much, Kieran.
Thank you. I think I'm going to... I'll try standing and see how this works. So thank you very much. It's an honor to be here and pleasure to be back in England, although you may not be able to tell this from my accent. I'm originally from England, from Yorkshire, but I've been away a long time now. And as it were, the topic of my paper is the phenomenon that I no longer know how to speak properly. Unfortunately, I now speak with this. At one point, it was a perfect transatlantic twang, and now it just sounds American. And the question is, what happened to me? What went wrong? Have I forgotten some truths about how to speak properly, how to pronounce words in the way I would like to pronounce them? Or has there been some change in, not in my beliefs or knowledge, but in some non-propositionally directed practical capacities? Of course, the topic is not just my particular incapacity, but something more general, namely the relationship between intentional action and knowing how to do things. And in the talk, I'm going to argue for two main claims. First, that knowing how to fi, as it relates to intentional action, is not propositional knowledge. So-called intellectualism about knowing how is false. And the second claim I'm going to argue for is that there's a path or an argument from the non-propositional character of knowing how to a picture of the will or the capacity to act intentionally or the capacity to act for reasons as a capacity to know. I'm going to argue that unless we accept a certain Anscombian conception of the will, we can't explain what's epistemological or epistemic about knowing how, why knowing how to fi is a genuine form of knowledge. So the handout's divided up into sections, and I'll refer to it occasionally, but I'll often forget to do that. I'm going to start with a simple claim that is on the handout, that if A is doing phi intentionally, then A knows how to phi. So the thought is, you can't intentionally do what you don't know how to do. And I think that's a very tempting idea, but there are some difficult cases. So in certain cases of non-basic action, where you do A by doing B, and the means you're taking are known to be risky or problematic or perhaps even unlikely to succeed, it's appeared to some people, and to me at earlier points, that you can succeed in doing A by doing B and count as doing A intentionally, even though you don't know how to do A. That seemed tempting to me. Now, in the paper from which I'm giving the talk, I go through some of the complexities there and try and make some suggestions about what's going on. But what I ultimately do is try to work around the problem, and that's what I'm going to do in the talk. So it seems that in all of the problem cases for the simple claim, they're all cases in which you are doing A by doing B, and while you may or may not know how to do A, you do know how to do B. So there's a qualified principle that isn't threatened by these kinds of cases that's also on the handout, that if A is doing phi intentionally, A knows how to phi, or else he's doing it by doing other things that he does know how to do. A consequence of that qualified principle is that you can't phi intentionally as a basic action unless you know how to phi. So when you're doing phi as a basic action, you're not doing it by intentionally doing other things or intentionally taking certain means. And it follows that for basic intentional action, the qualification that I just went through isn't going to matter. And we can rely on a restricted version of the simple claim. So this is on the handout as basic knowledge, that if A is doing phi intentionally as a basic action, A knows how to phi. So my focus in the talk is going to be the explanation of basic knowledge, understanding why this principle, basic knowledge, is true. Assuming the possibility of basic intentional action, I'm going to argue that knowing how to perform such actions doesn't consist in propositional knowledge, can't be identified with propositional knowledge. Now, I want to mention as an aside that, again, I go into at a bit more length in the paper, that the assumption of the possibility of basic intentional action has been questioned, and there are various challenges and replies to work through. The point I want to make now is a fairly modest one, that just assuming the possibility of basic intentional action is very much weaker than assuming, which many people do, that every intentional action is ultimately performed by basic means. So many people have the thought there's some kind of regress that forces you to think of every intentional action as performed by basic means, and all of the means to perform that action can be broken down into basic components. What I'm assuming is much, much weaker, just that it is possible for people to perform basic intentional actions, to fly intentionally without taking intentional means. I'm not going to make the stronger assumption. And if you have questions even about the weaker assumption, I'd be happy to try to defend it in discussion. So that's the starting point. This is section two, against intellectualism. So let me start with a very simple propositional theory about knowing how to fly. According to the very simple propositional theory applied to basic action, our target, knowing how to perform a basic intentional action is just knowledge of ability. It's just knowing that you're able to perform it. So you know how to fly, where flying is a basic action, just in case you know that you're able to fly. The problem for that very simplistic view is that you can fly intentionally without knowing that you're able to do so. So imagine this case. My arm has been paralyzed for some time, and there's no hint of a cure, but I'm irrationally optimistic. And I think, you know, I think I might be getting better. And in particular, I think I'm able to clench my fist. I believe that I'm able to clench my fist. Now, as it happens, my belief is true, but it's completely unjustified and doesn't count as knowledge. I don't know that I'm able to clench my fist. I don't think any of that stops me from intending to clench my fist, trying to clench my fist, and successfully doing so, and indeed clenching my fist intentionally. And if we suppose this is going to be the illustrative case of basic intentional action I use, if you don't agree, substitute your own example. If we suppose that I clench my fist as a basic intentional action, it follows by basic knowledge that I do know how to clench my fist, even though I don't know that I'm able to do so. So the simple equation of knowing how to do something with knowledge of ability doesn't work for basic action. That little argument is an instance of a broader challenge to intellectualism, the view that knowing how to fly is knowledge of a proposition. And the question really is whether the intellectualist can account for basic knowledge. Another way to put that, what is it about the nature of intentional action and knowing how, at least in the case of basic intentional action, that makes it impossible to have one of them, intentional action, without the other, knowing how to perform that action? And I think it's the need to explain the truth of basic knowledge that undermines intellectualism about knowing how. So I just said how a very simple theory fails that test. It can't explain, and in fact conflicts with, basic knowledge. What about the more sophisticated views of contemporary intellectualists? So building on a paper he wrote with Timothy Williamson, Jason Stanley has a book which develops at some length what I think is the most plausible, certainly the most elaborately worked out propositional theory of knowing how. And I've got a summary of his view on the handout. This is Stanley's intellectualism. Knowing how, according to Stanley, knowing how to fly is knowing of some way of doing fly with which you're acquainted under a practical way of thinking that it's a way in which you could fly. Okay, so three elements of that thesis I think need further explanation. First, what is a way of doing fly? So what Stanley says is that ways are properties of actions, which are certain kinds of events, and just as where means at which place, how means in what way. In short, the word how ranges over the meanings of adverbs. So ways are properties of actions that are the meanings of adverbs. And adverbs of particular interest to me and for our purposes are ones that take the form by doing X. Cautionary point about that, we shouldn't assume that the way in which you know how to fly, according to Stanley, is always going to involve some intentional means to the relevant end. It's always going to be another intentional action. And that's going to be important for the case of basic action in a minute. Second clarification of Stanley's view, what are practical ways of thinking? So Stanley has this broadly Frickian view on which thoughts or propositions are more finely grained than Russellian propositions. They incorporate ways of thinking of the objects and properties that they're about. And that's supposed to explain how it's possible to believe of some object you know under a description that it's F without knowing of that very same object given demonstratively that it's F, or how you know of yourself under the first person that you're sitting down but don't know of yourself given in some other way that you're sitting down. And so, according to Stanley, for ways of doing things given by description, by demonstratives, or in a practical way, under a practical mode of presentation or way of thinking, which is just supposed to be a distinctive kind of mode of presentation of a way of doing something, of an action. An important fact about ways of thinking, according to Stanley's picture, is that they can involve dispositions to act on and be affected by their objects. So if knowing how to fly involves a disposition to act in certain ways in certain circumstances, or a capacity to act in certain ways in certain circumstances, that it involves a practical way of thinking of a way of acting can explain how. So there's a kind of dialectical point connected with this, which is unless you're willing to get into the nitty-gritty of the theory of practical ways of thinking, which I'm not really going to do in this talk, it's going to be difficult to argue that Stanley's theory fails to give sufficient conditions for knowing how, because any non-propositional knowledge conditions that you claim to be involved in knowing how, he's just going to throw into the practical way of thinking or practical mode of presentation, thereby guaranteeing that it's strong enough to be sufficient for knowing how. And that's why, as you'll see when I argue against Stanley's view, what I focus on is the claim that the conditions that he provides are necessary for knowing how to do something. Okay, final clarification of Stanley's view. How to interpret could in the statement of his view? He insists that we mustn't interpret it as ability in the ordinary sense. So in general, he's thinking modal auxiliaries like could are highly context sensitive. And ignoring some details, he's adapting Kratz's view of modal auxiliaries. A use of A could phi is true just in case A succeeds in phi-ing in some contextually salient world. And then the crucial point for Stanley, this is quoted on the handout, is that the difference between, I'll just read this out, the difference between explicit ability modals and ascriptions of knowing how is that the former typically requires success in conditions like those obtaining in the actual world. In contrast, ascriptions of knowing how tolerate cases in which there's counterfactual success only in more distant situations. So he's thinking, well, maybe the conditions under which you succeed when you know you can, in the sense relevant to knowing how, are ones in which your body is working properly, or as it normally does, not the actual conditions in which your body isn't working properly. And that's supposed to deal with the case of recent paralysis that I mentioned a few minutes ago, the objection to the very simple equation of knowing how to fly with knowledge of ability. His thought is, well, maybe you don't know that you're able to clench your fist. Still, you do know of a way of clenching your fist with which you're acquainted under a practical way of thinking, that it's a way in which you could clench your fist, and that you would do so in that way if you were healthy and not paralyzed. Something like that is the truth condition anyway. So when I clench my fist intentionally, knowing how to do so, but irrationally optimistic, I needn't know that I'm able to clench my fist in the ordinary sense in order to have the propositional knowledge that Stanley is equating with knowing how to clench my fist. So the example is supposed to be resolved. It doesn't conflict with Stanley's intellectualism, this more sophisticated form of intellectualism. I don't think, however, that this solves the deeper problem. We can begin, I think, by asking a question that Stanley is strangely silent about in his book. What is the content of my knowledge when I know how to clench my fist as a basic intentional action? So for non-basic actions, it's not particularly mysterious what kind of propositional knowledge might be thought to constitute knowing how to perform the action. It's knowledge that you can do so by taking such and such means. But in the case of basic action, that answer doesn't seem to be available. And he's really not explicit in the book about what the content of knowing how to perform a basic action is. You might think, well, maybe it's like this. When I know how to clench my fist as a basic intentional action, I know of clenching my fist given to me under a practical mode of presentation, or way of thinking, that it's a way in which I could clench my fist. But I don't think that can be right. In that case, what I would know is that I can clench my fist by doing this, where this is supposed to be not a perceptual demonstrative, but a practical way of thinking. And doing this would be the basic intentional action. Don't be misled here by the fact that, in some sense, doing this and clenching my fist are the same thing. For our purposes, actions have got to be as finely individuated as the contents of intentions and thoughts. That's to say, as finely individuated as Stanley's ways of thinking. So doing this, sort of practical mode of presentation, and clenching my fist are distinct actions. I think a better view for Stanley to take about what you know when you know how to perform a basic action, and this was the view I was sort of trying to push him towards in talking about this stuff, is that when I know how to clench my fist as a basic intentional action, I know that I could do so by intending to clench my fist. Where, crucially, intending to clench my fist is not itself an intentional action. So it's not that there's some further means by which I clench my fist, performing the intentional action of intending to clench my fist. It's rather that there's a way in which I could clench my fist, an adverb, by intending to do so. And I know that I could clench my fist by intending to. And that's what I know when I know how to perform the basic action of intentionally clenching my fist. So the question then is, okay, if that's supposed to be the content of the propositional knowledge that constitutes knowing how to perform a basic action, am I guaranteed to, bound to, have that propositional knowledge when I intentionally clench my fist as a basic action? In other words, can we explain, on Stanley's view, the truth of basic knowledge? And he thinks the answer is yes. So here's a longish quote on the second page of the handout that's really the sort of crucial attempt to respond to earlier versions of this worry that I raised in another paper. He says, well, look, raising a problem for the conjunction of what I'm calling basic knowledge and his view of knowing how would require an example of a Gettyard case of basic action, where the agent genuinely lacks knowledge of counterfactual success. It's not clear to me that there are persuasive cases of this kind, because I have a hard time imagining cases in which someone can reliably clench their fist on the basis of their intention to do so, and yet lacks the propositional knowledge in question. In the case of basic actions such as fist clenchings, it may be sufficient for possession of the propositional knowledge in question that the subject has the disposition to clench their fist in the relevant manner when they form the intention to do so, as long as the agent possesses the relevant concept, such as the concept of a fist. Certainly, the behavior of clenching one's fist is a characteristic expression of the relevant propositional knowledge. Finally, if an agent lacks such a disposition, it's not clear to me that her action in clenching her fist will be best described as intentional, as opposed, presumably, to some kind of accidental success. Now, that passage is, I think, in certain ways misleading. The problem of basic knowledge for Stanley's intellectualism doesn't really depend on finding Gettyard cases of basic action in which I believe with justification that I could clench my fist by intending to do so, but I don't know that that's true. Nor does it depend on finding cases of basic action in which my belief in counterfactual success is true, but not justified. It was an accident that the case of recent paralysis I gave before happened to be of that kind. The most that's required is a case of basic intentional action in which I don't know that I could clench my fist by intending to do so, either because my belief is Gettyard, or because it's unjustified, or because I lack the relevant belief. And I think it's really the final possibility, the case where you just don't have the relevant belief, that's the most challenging one for Stanley's view. Now, I admit that it's not particularly easy to imagine someone clenching her fist intentionally without the belief that she can do so by intending to do so. But the fact that that's hard to imagine is not really enough for the defense of Stanley's view. What's required is an explanation of the truth of basic knowledge, on which it derives from the nature of basic intentional action and knowing how. So like Stanley, I'm assuming that it's a condition of clenching your fist intentionally as a basic action, that you'll be disposed to act in the relevant way when you intend to do so. In fact, I would make a stronger claim. I think it's sufficient for basic intentional action that you form and execute the intention to act, in that your action is guided by the relevant intention. The notion of guidance I'm invoking here is one that various philosophers of action have appealed to and have tried to explain in different ways. For my purposes, I don't think it really matters what the explanation is. It doesn't matter whether guidance is a causal concept, whether it can be explained in other terms at all. What matters is that I don't need any more than the intention to clench my fist and the disposition to do so under the guidance of that intention in order to clench my fist intentionally as a basic action. So if basic knowledge is true, it has to follow from the nature of those elements, the ones I just mentioned, the intention and the disposition to execute it. It has to follow from the nature of those elements that I know how to clench my fist. So what Stanley owes us is an account of what it is to have the relevant intention and what it is to have the relevant disposition, on which their presence entails that you have the belief that you could clench your fist by intending to do so. And the problem here, I think, isn't just one of omission, that he hasn't filled in this little bit of his theory, but that it's actually very difficult to see how any plausible account of intention or guidance or the relevant disposition would entail the inevitable presence of the relevant belief. So while it's hard to imagine, say, an agent who doesn't have the concept could, possession of that concept is not, on the face of it, part of what's involved in intending to clench one's fist as a basic intentional action, or in executing that intention. I mean, think by contrast of the concept of a fist or clenching your fist, which does seem to be involved in forming and executing the relevant intention. What's more, even if the concept could does have to be involved in your intention for some reason or other, the conditions of basic intentional action, that you intend to clench your fist and you're disposed to execute this intention disposed to act under the guidance of that intention, those conditions don't require you to put that concept together with others in the way described by Stanley's view. It just doesn't follow from one's having the intention to clench one's fist, and the concept could, that one believes one could clench one's fist by intending to do so. It might be risky or foolish to intend what you don't believe you can do, but it's not impossible. Nor does it follow that you have that belief just because you're disposed, as it happens, to succeed. Here's another way to make the same basic point against Stanley's view. He may be right that the behavior of clenching your fist is the characteristic expression of knowing that you can clench your fist by intending to do so. Clenching your fist as a basic intentional action is just what you'd expect of someone who knows that they can by intending to do so. And given the appeal to practical ways of thinking, maybe the disposition to act on that intention is a necessary condition of the relevant propositional knowledge. The problem is, it's not sufficient for the relevant propositional knowledge. So even on a kind of fairly simple functionalist account of knowledge and belief, they're going to involve complicated multi-track dispositions to act in different ways, in different circumstances, to form and revise other mental states. And to have a given belief, it's not going to be enough that you're disposed in one of those ways. And in particular, it's not sufficient for the belief that you could clench your fist by intending to do so, that you be disposed to clench your fist when you so intend. That disposition alone is not sufficient for the presence of the belief that Stanley is identifying with knowing how to clench your fist. And so the belief isn't necessary for the performance of the basic intentional action. Now, none of that implies that knowledge of counterfactual success is irrelevant to action theory. Maybe it plays some important role in explaining how we know what we're doing when we do it intentionally. But while knowledge of counterfactual success may be required, maybe, for knowledge of intentional action, it's not required for the performance of the intentional action itself. Since knowing how to perform the action is required for basic intentional action, as basic knowledge tells us, Stanley's intellectualism fails. It can't explain why basic knowledge holds. So that's the argument against Stanley's intellectualism. Although I can't prove it, I think this kind of objection is going to generalize to other forms of intellectualism for two main reasons. One is that Stanley's intellectualism is the form of intellectualism that's motivated by, that's motivated by the linguistics of knowing who, what, where, when, why. And since that's really the most powerful case for intellectualism, there's reason to think that if intellectualism is true, it's going to take something like Stanley's form. The second reason why I think this kind of concern is likely to generalize is that the strategy depends on emphasizing how minimal the conditions are of basic intentional action. So what's creating the problem is not anything specific about the concept could or about the particular details of Stanley's view. What's creating the problem is that the only concepts and beliefs involved in clenching your fist intentionally as a basic action are the concepts and beliefs required to intend to clench your fist and for that intention to guide your action. And it just doesn't look like any of the concepts and beliefs required for that are plausibly identified with knowing how to clench your fist. So in effect, the materials required that are sufficient for the performance of a basic intentional action look too thin and impoverished to find propositional knowledge that could plausibly be identified with knowing how to fie. So my conclusion is that knowing how to fie is not, in the case of basic action at least, a matter of propositional knowledge. So what I'm going to try to do in the last two sections of the paper is give a brief sketch of what knowing how to perform an action could be, and to explore some of the implications, or at least one kind of implication that I think the non-propositional view is likely to have. So section three, what is knowing how? So the argument I've been giving against intellectualism suggests that knowing how to perform a basic action, at least, is just being disposed to act on the relevant intention when you have it. Like other dispositions, that one can be masked or prevented from manifesting in unfavorable circumstances. So being disposed to execute the intention doesn't imply that you will execute the intention whenever you have it, that you would always succeed. When your intention does guide the performance of basic action, you manifest the disposition to act on that intention. No accident that you're performing the action in the presence of the intention. And that disposition is therefore a condition of doing phi intentionally or clenching your fist, say, intentionally as a basic action. So if we identify knowing how to perform a basic intentional action with that disposition, we can explain the truth of basic knowledge, because that disposition to execute your intention is bound to be present whenever you perform the basic intentional action by executing your intention. Well, how about knowing how to perform a non-basic action? Presumably, it's sufficient for knowing how to perform a non-basic intentional action that I have propositional knowledge of basic means and that I know how to take those means. But it's hard to believe that that's really necessary for knowing how to perform a basic action. You can see this if you just think about general know-how. So an example would be knowing how to make toast. I know how to make toast. I don't know how to make toast as a basic intentional action. I can't make it just like that. Whenever I make toast, I take various means. But if you ask me right now, or if you ask the question about me right now, do I know a series of basic intentional actions by which I could make toast? The answer is no. If I was asked to make toast, or I was called upon to make toast, I'd figure it out as I went along. This looks like a case where I know how to do something, I have a kind of general know-how. What I know how to perform is a non-basic intentional action, But my knowledge how to perform this action doesn't consist in knowledge of basic means, plus knowledge how to take those means. My tentative thought is, well, why not just generalize the account of basic know-how? Why not say that knowing how to fly in the practical sense, just in general, is being disposed to fly when you so intend, perhaps by determining further actions by which you can perform the action of doing fly, by finding various means as the occasion demands. That disposition might well depend on propositional knowledge of means. Maybe there's a bunch of propositional knowledge about toasters, at least that you make toast with toasters and things like that, that I have to have, and in the absence of which I just wouldn't be disposed to succeed in making toast when I intend to make toast. Still, of the various means I do have propositional knowledge of, many are ones that I couldn't now specify and don't now have knowledge of basic means to perform. My knowledge of how to perform them really does consist just in the disposition to succeed. So that's my tentative proposal about what knowing how to fly in the practical sense is. Just in general, it's to be understood in terms of the disposition to act on one's intention. A couple of questions or problem cases that I'll work through for this to try and suggest that it's reasonably robust, reasonably defensible. You might ask, well, is being disposed to act on the intention to fly really sufficient for knowing how to fly, even when doing fly is not a basic action? Difficult case raised by Catherine Hawley is one in which it looks like counterfactual success, or the disposition to succeed, isn't sufficient for knowing how to fly because your success is accidental. So here's a quote from her. She says, "Consider Susie, who likes to annoy Joe and believes that she does so by smoking. In fact, Joe is annoyed by Susie's tapping on her cigarette box, which she does whenever she smokes. Susie would succeed in annoying Joe if she tried, but it seems that she doesn't know how to annoy Joe because she misconstrues the situation." So is that a case of being disposed to execute your intention but not knowing how to annoy Joe? And I think, no, it isn't. It's the problem with cases like that is that although they're ones in which Susie annoys Joe, or it's one in which Susie annoys Joe, she doesn't annoy him intentionally. It's a case of non-basic deviance in the causation of action. We don't need to solve the problem of non-basic deviance in order to just avoid it here. The crucial thing is, what matters for knowing how in the practical sense is being disposed to execute your intention in intentional action. That's the disposition that I'm claiming is sufficient for knowing how. Different sort of problem comes up in cases where I'm disposed to acquire the knowledge I need in order to do something, even though I don't yet possess it. So suppose I don't know how to play chess, but if I decided to play, I'd read the instructions, I'd learn how, and I'd figure it out. Am I disposed to play chess when I intend to do so, even though I don't know how to play chess? The answer, I think, is that I lack that disposition. Although I could learn how to play chess, I'm not now disposed to recognize the means by which to make legal moves, and so not now disposed to succeed in playing chess under the guidance of my intention. In this respect, my relationship to chess is very different from my relationship to making toast. In neither case do I know basic means by which I could do so now, but I'm already disposed to recognize the means by which I can make toast on a given occasion. Not so the means to playing chess. In effect, this is a case of what in the literature on dispositions is called altering. It's a case in which I would fly in C, I would play chess if I formed the intention to do so, not because I'm disposed to do so now, but because I would go on to acquire that disposition. So I don't think cases like this threaten the identification of knowing how to fly with the disposition to act on your intention. Final challenge could be posed from the other side, not that this kind of disposition is insufficient for knowing how to fly, but that it's unnecessary. Can't we say of someone who has read and understood, say, an elaborate textbook on the construction of spaceships, that he knows how to build a spaceship, even though he's not disposed to succeed when he forms the relevant intention? I'm inclined to answer yes, in a sense. That sentence, "he knows how to build a spaceship," can be used to state a truth about him, namely that the textbook reader has propositional knowledge of some way of building a spaceship, that it's a way in which he could do so, or maybe a way in which one could do so. It's just that he doesn't know how to take the relevant means. How to make sense of this? I think what's going on is, the hypothesis I have about what's going on is one that Ian Rumford proposes in a paper criticizing Stanley and Williamson a while back, namely that knows how to is just ambiguous between an embedded question reading, for which something like the Stanley account is right, and a reading which is subject to the dispositional theory. That's why I've been periodically qualifying my statements about knowing how by saying knowing how to fi in the practical sense, or knowing how to fi in the sense that relates to intentional action, is being disposed to act on the relevant intention when you have it. So in one sense, the textbook reader knows how to build a spaceship, but as we might protest, he doesn't really know how to do it himself. In the sense that's relevant to basic knowledge and intentional action, he doesn't know how. So the thesis that there's an ambiguity here obviously brings us close to the linguistic arguments for and against intellectualism, and I'm not going to try to go into those. What I think about them is more or less what Rumfitt thinks about them, namely, there is an ambiguity here. It's marked explicitly in certain languages, as in the distinction between savoir-faire and savoir-comment-faire. It's not marked explicitly in English. Rumfitt makes a stronger claim than I would, namely that the linguistic evidence positively refutes intellectualism. Stanley's response, I think, is fair, namely that if there were very powerful general arguments for intellectualism, there will be ways to cope with the linguistic evidence. My point is not that the linguistic evidence favors anti-intellectualism, just that the linguistic evidence doesn't conclusively favor intellectualism. It's not completely ad hoc to say what I just said, namely, oh, knows how to is ambiguous between an embedded question reading and the practical reading that I've been giving an account of. So I want to end by talking about a final challenge to the non-propositional view that I've defended. This is a challenge on sort of broadly conceptual grounds. For intellectualists, it's perfectly clear why knowing how to fi should count as knowledge, why the same verb figures in savoir-faire and savoir-comment-faire. For the intellectualist, knowing how to fi is just knowledge that P for some P. The epistemic character of knowing how, its knowledge-y character, is much more puzzling on a non-propositional view. In particular, to make this vivid, turn to the case of basic action, where I'm suggesting knowing how to fi is the disposition to act and the intention to fi. Why conceive of that disposition as a form of knowledge? Why think of that as a kind of epistemic state or epistemic achievement? Why is it right to describe this mere disposition, one that need not involve a belief about your own capacities, in epistemic terms? And it's to that question that I'm going to turn in closing. So this is section 4 on practical knowledge. Okay, so I'm going to approach this question, why is this disposition epistemic? What's epistemic about it? By way of some claims about knowledge of intentional action that are inspired by Anscombe's book, Intention. So according to Anscombe, at least on a sort of straightforward reading, this is on the handout, if A is doing phi intentionally, A knows that he's doing phi without observation. If I'm talking intentionally, I know that I'm talking, and I know it without observation. Now, Anscombe doesn't deny that knowledge of one's intentional actions often draws on empirical or other knowledge of the world, but it's not exhausted by that kind of knowledge. It's not exhausted by empirical knowledge of the world. There's a passage, I think, that sort of spells this out. I'm not going to read it out. It's on the handout. The way I read Anscombe's view is roughly this. Knowledge of intentional action doesn't rest on sufficient prior evidence, either perceptual evidence or inferential support. Now, the epistemology of that kind of knowledge, this kind of knowledge of intentional action, has been found puzzling by a lot of people. I mean, how can you know you're doing something if you don't have adequate evidence that you're doing it, at least adequate evidence beforehand? How can you permissibly form the belief that you're doing it if that belief outruns what you have evidence to believe is the case? I've tried to address that kind of epistemological concern about Anscombe elsewhere, I'm not going to focus on that here, but I will say a little bit about some more mundane objections, just straightforward counterexamples that people have raised to the sort of simple Anscombe thesis on the handout. So, case that gets discussed often here is Davidson's carbon copier. He imagines someone making 10 carbon copies. He's pressing hard on the paper. He's not sure that the copies are going through. Davidson says, if they are, he's making 10 copies intentionally. But he doesn't know that he's making 10 copies intentionally. All he knows is that he's trying. You might think, well, maybe this is like the examples I mentioned way back in section one, where you're, although you don't know you're doing A intentionally, you're doing it by doing B, say, pressing hard on the paper, and you do know that you're doing B intentionally. But actually, there are cases that raise trouble for that. So you think of variations on the paralysis case, where we're supposing that clenching your fist intentionally is a basic action. I think there are going to be cases where I successfully clench my fist intentionally, but don't actually know that I'm clenching my fist, because suppose it's anesthetized, it's behind my back, I can't see it, I can't feel it. In fact, it's not paralyzed, I clench it, I'm irrationally optimistic maybe, I believe I'm clenching my fist, but I don't know that I'm clenching my fist, even though I'm doing it intentionally. And this isn't a case where, oh, but you're doing it by taking further means. By hypothesis, we were thinking of a case of basic intentional action. So I think there are, the problems for Anscombe's simple thesis go fairly deep. What I think they turn on is a simplification that's actually pretty often made in epistemology, or actually used to be very often made in epistemology, namely ignoring partial belief, just focusing on the case of knowledge and plain old belief, and not worrying about degrees of confidence or partial belief or being pretty sure but not certain. And that simplification, I think, in much the same way has been characteristically made in the philosophy of action in discussing phenomena like practical knowledge. I think that's what's causing the trouble for the Anscombean picture. When you act intentionally, you may not have knowledge of what you're doing or believe that you're doing it, but that's consistent with thinking that intentional action is bound up with a capacity for partial belief, or belief or partial belief, that doesn't rest on observation or inference, for confidence about what you're doing that outruns your prior evidence. Now, it's not very easy to formulate a confidence condition as just a necessary condition on doing A intentionally. I think a more promising way of getting at the core idea is not to focus on particular actions, but just to think about the will, the capacity to act intentionally, as a capacity for non-perceptual, non-inferential knowledge of what you're doing and why. The knowledge you have when you exercise the will is practical in that it motivates action. Though, is that causal? Is it not causal? Don't need to get into that. But the capacity may not issue in knowledge. Under non-ideal conditions, what it may issue in is mere belief or partial belief. To adapt, so that I think there's nothing more mysterious about that kind of claim. You know, the will is a capacity for knowledge, but sometimes things aren't so great. You think you're doing something, but you're not, or think you might be doing it, or you have a certain degree of confidence that you're doing it, but you can't be sure. I don't think that's any more mysterious than, say, the idea that perception is a capacity for knowledge, or we have a capacity for perceptual knowledge, but that in non-ideal circumstances, that capacity yields not knowledge, maybe not even belief, but rational changes in your degrees of belief. So just to take an example, on the basis of visual perception, you may become more confident of something without achieving full belief or knowledge. So suppose I'm looking at a distant figure in the ocean at dusk. Is it a man or a woman swimming towards me or away from me, waving or drowning? I'm not sure. But perception rationally affects my degree of confidence in all those things in legitimate ways. And in doing so, I'm manifesting a capacity for perceptual knowledge, but just under adverse conditions. I think the same thing can be said of the capacity to act for reasons as the capacity to know what I'm doing and why. The exercise of that capacity is going to interact with evidence of other kinds, And it may affect your degree of confidence about what you're doing without sufficing for knowledge or belief. That's what happens in the cases of recent paralysis, I think. Cases where I'm clenching my fist intentionally, but only partly believe that I'm doing so, because I'm not sure that I've recovered. Examples like that don't refute the Anscombian conception of the will, any more than examples of perceptual uncertainty refute the idea of perception as a source of knowledge. Okay, so what I've been doing so far is just sort of setting out a version of Anscombe's view that I find tempting and that I think is consistent with various kinds of problem cases. We could think of intention as knowledge or partial belief that motivates action and that can legitimately outrun your prior evidence. I haven't argued that we should think of the will in that way or of intention in that way. And though some people find the idea that there's a connection, some deep connection between intentional action and self-knowledge, knowledge without observation or inference of what you're doing, immediately obvious and compelling, I've learned that some people don't find this idea so compelling and want to know why they should accept that this connection holds. So I actually think there's a whole bunch of arguments for this connection, many of which I've tried to develop, beginning with simple thoughts like, well, isn't the ordinary expression of an intention in action, I'm doing so-and-so, which looks for all the world like, among other things, an expression of the belief that you're doing so-and-so. There's also a whole bunch of more indirect arguments. So I think this picture of the will helps us to understand instrumental reason, helps us to understand the impossibility of believing at will. I think it helps us to understand self-knowledge of one's own intentions. What I'm going to present right now is a further indirect argument, another argument that the Anscombian picture of the will helps us to make sense of something that would be otherwise puzzling. So you can predict what it's going to be. Unless we think of the will as a capacity for knowledge of action, I'm going to suggest, we can't explain why or understand why knowing how to fly is genuinely a form of knowledge. So we can't answer the challenge that I raised at the end of section 3 and have been working up to answering. And the thought here is relatively simple. Take an instance of basic intentional action, so intentionally clenching my fist. Knowing how to do so is being disposed to act on the relevant intention if I have it. I think we can see why that disposition should be conceived as knowledge or as an epistemic achievement if we accept two further claims. First, the Anscombian view on which, at least if this is a paradigm case of intentional action, I know without observation or inference that I'm clenching my fist. And my intention constitutes that knowledge. That's knowledge in intention. Second, that the disposition helps to make that knowledge possible by explaining why the relevant belief is non-accidentally true. Its truth is no accident because I'm disposed to act on that intention if I have it. It's not an accident that when I intend to clench my fist and thus believe that I'm doing so, my belief is true. Now, in saying that, I'm not sort of identifying knowledge with non-accidentally true belief. The point is just to say that in the Anscombian picture, the disposition to act on your intention does epistemic work. If knowing how to perform a basic action is a disposition of that kind, it's at the same time an epistemic capacity. It's a determination of the capacity for practical knowledge, that is, the will. Although its epistemic role is quite different from that of knowing a proposition, knowing how to perform a basic action makes practical knowledge possible, and in that way counts as knowledge, as an epistemic achievement, too. So what I've argued is that knowing how to fly in the practical sense is being disposed to act on the relevant intention when you have it, and the Anscombian view explains why that state should count as knowledge, even when it doesn't involve knowledge of means. The explanation isn't that every enabling condition of knowledge is itself an instance of knowledge, but that on the Anscombian view, the disposition involved in knowing how to fly is a capacity to know. And crucially, no similar story can be told by those who reject the Anscombian view. If intention is a mere non-cognitive state, an attitude that motivates action but doesn't involve any belief about it, why is the disposition to act on one's intention rightly conceived as knowledge, as an epistemic achievement? Of course, it's something you could know about, and that knowledge might help to explain how you know what you're doing. But the disposition as such, the knowing how itself, is epistemically inert. It's propositional knowledge that does the work on other views, and there's no need to regard the disposition as knowledge in its own right. If we want to make sense of know-how as knowledge in a non-propositional theory of knowing how, we're pushed towards a picture of the will as a capacity to know. There's a path from anti-intellectualism about knowing how to the possibility of practical knowledge. Thank you.